Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine, who assesses the prospects for success of the latest Middle East peace plan recently accepted by both the Israeli and Palestinian governments. Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University, who discusses the recent UN vote to lift sanctions against Iraq as the future of a post-US occupation government remains uncertain. And Jonathan Schell, columnist and author of The Unconquerable World, who examines alternatives to the cycle of violence and war which have again been unleashed after the September 11th terrorist attacks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a dangerous new militaristic posture, the U.S. Senate has voted to lift a 10-year ban on research and development on small nuclear weapons with warheads of less than 5 kilotons. Arms control advocates have long opposed such mini-nukes, saying they are more likely to be used as tactical nuclear weapons. According to Slate, the online magazine, the end of the nuclear ban is a big victory for Keith Payne, a longtime pro-nuclear advocate and current Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Forces Policy. Payne made a name for himself in 1980 by co-writing an article in Foreign Policy magazine that endorsed an offensive nuclear strategy and insisted that limiting U.S. deaths to only 20 million people was, quote, a level compatible with national survival and recovery. In a January 2001 paper on nuclear policy, Payne and other conservatives advocated using nuclear weapons in military operations like the 1991 Gulf War and to destroy underground bunkers, such as biological weapons facilities. As Slate magazine noted, many of Payne's controversial ideas were incorporated into the 2002 Nuclear Posture Review that was leaked to the press, where for the first time the Pentagon viewed nuclear weapons as complements to conventional weapons systems. Campaigning to prevent a U.S. military attack on Iraq in 1991 and again in 2003, hundreds of thousands of American activists protested and lobbied unsuccessfully for peace. In 1991, the elder President Bush drove Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait and declared that the Vietnam Syndrome was dead. Demoralized, many peace groups folded and were branded as relics of the 1960s. One year later, the Republican president was beaten by centrist upstart Bill Clinton. According to the news magazine In These Times, peace activists believe this time around will be different. With Baghdad still in ruins, the flexing of unilateral American power remains unpopular in much of the world. There is also widespread concern that new U.S. wars could soon be launched against Iran, Syria, or North Korea. At home, the anti-war camp has much deeper roots than it had 12 years ago, with strong ties to organized labor, women's, and environmental groups. Mainstream groups like Peace Action are already looking forward to the 2004 election by launching a voter registration campaign in conjunction with TomPaine.com, TrueMajority.org, and Rock the Vote. As Tom Kingston of Global Exchange noted, any sort of peace campaign that is pro-education or pro-public health has to be bound up with foreign policy because so many resources are now going to the military. Detroit resident Eddie Joe Lloyd was released from prison last summer after a DNA test proved him innocent of rape and murder charges that landed him a jail sentence of nearly 20 years. Lloyd was the 110th person to be found innocent by DNA testing, according to the Innocence Project, based at the New York Cardozo School of Law. According to Amnesty International, police investigators faced with the historic 1966 Miranda ruling now rely on playing psychological games with defendants to force confessions to crimes of violence. A systematic violation of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, false confessions have played a central role in 20% of all case reversals. Police investigators are now taught how to befriend suspects and gain their trust. The goal is to get the defendant to waive their Miranda rights to an attorney. When these rights are waived, the real interrogation begins, often using false statements from witnesses or distortions of actual crime scene evidence. Richard Leo, criminologist at the University of California at Irvine, explained, "Any confession, even if withdrawn, has a powerful impact on a jury. It is a damning and compelling evidence of guilt." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Although the latest plan for peace in the Middle East, known as the Roadmap, was drawn up and awaiting action for many months, the proposal wasn't given serious attention until just days before the U.S. launched its war against Iraq. Now, after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein's regime, the roadmap is moving forward with an endorsement from the new Palestinian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas, and half-hearted acceptance from the Israeli government of Ariel Sharon. The plan, put forward by the U.S., the European Union, the U.N., and Russia, envisions the cessation of hostilities leading to the establishment of a Palestinian state within 3 years. But critics of the Blueprint for Peace worry about opposition to the plan from hardliners on both sides, and that many of the most difficult negotiations will not begin until the final and third phase of the plan. Contentious issues such as the dismantling of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, and the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their former homes, are formidable obstacles which could derail the plan. Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine, has for many years been working for a just solution to decades of Middle East violence. He co-founded a new organization called the Tikkun Community with co-chair Harvard professor Cornel West, which serves as a progressive alternative to conservative Jewish lobby groups that generally back Israel's aggressive policies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rabbi Lerner about how he views the prospects for success of the latest Middle East peace plan.
Although I'm glad that there have been some steps forward on the roadmap is so deeply flawed that it seems extremely unlikely that it's going to lead anywhere positive. Because let me tell you the two reasons why it's significantly flawed. Number one, the roadmap says that both sides must take a certain number of steps that will take place over the course of the next 3 years. And at the end of those 3 years, there will be a negotiation about what the final settlement will be. But those steps, from the standpoint of the Palestinians, is going to require that Palestinian moderates are able to silence and stop all acts of violence from the Palestinian extremists. Now, of course, I wish that could happen because I would very much like to see an end to all acts of violence against Israeli civilians on the part of Palestinians. On the other hand, I don't think that there's a chance that they will stop unless the moderates in the Palestinian world have something concrete to offer the extremists in the Palestinian world. And what the roadmap offers is that if the moderates are able to silence and stop the extremists over the course of the next 3 years, then what? Then we will have a negotiation. But the negotiation will take place between two parties, one of whom is occupying the West Bank and Gaza, and the other of whom has no army and no significant military force. So they are extremely unequal powers that will then negotiate. Well, when you try to present this as the justification for stopping the acts of violence, which, as I say, I think are totally destructive to the Palestinian cause in any event, but that's not the basis of the argument that's being made. The basis of the argument is, you see, we'll end up with something. We'll end up with this great consequence at the end of the process. But there is no end of the process. At the end of the process will be a new negotiation, and they have been through that route before. Now, problem number two with the roadmap is that it totally empowers the most extremist elements and disempowers the moderate elements in the Palestinian world for the following reason. The moderates can take 3,000 steps along the roads to Middle East peace so that this roadmap supposedly lays out. And if there is just a few acts of violence on the part of a handful of violent people on either side, the whole thing collapses. So for these two reasons, this plan is very deeply flawed.
The U.S. media has focused a lot of positive attention on the fact that Ariel Sharon's government is the first government of the nation of Israel that has basically endorsed the idea of the creation of a Palestinian state. But as you said, there's a lot of cause for being skeptical that this actually will come to pass, given Ariel Sharon's record. And
yes, he said that he would accept a Palestinian state. Now, understand this, that what he has in mind is a state that would be less than 10% of pre-1948 Palestine, and that he's made it clear to all of his supporters that he has no intention of dismantling any of the major settlements that he has no intention of sending back into Israel any of the 320,000 Israeli settlers. All that he's willing to do is to take a few of these very extremely marginal settlements that were just set up the last 2 years that he has decided to label the illegal settlements, to contrast them with the rest, although by international law all of the settlements are illegal. So he's talking about a Palestinian state that will be a sliver, that will have no economic or political viability, that will be surrounded by Israeli troops, and that will essentially have no reality. The minimum that the Palestinians need, and I think it's the maximum that they can get and should get at this moment, is the West Bank and Gaza. And a state through most of the West Bank and Gaza would be something that would satisfy their needs, and I think should satisfy their needs. But so he's ending up giving them next to nothing and calling that a Palestinian state.
Rabbi Lerner, how inextricably linked do you feel Middle East peace is to solving and ending the threat and the very real promise of more terrorism in the world today?
Well, I think it's very important. I don't hold the view that this is the magic bullet and that once we solve the Israeli-Palestinian issue that the threat of terror will disappear. I think it's really a question of a new spirit and a new way of approaching politics. What we basically say is that there are two paradigms that have been contending in American history, one and actually in the world history, one between those who think that security can be achieved through domination and control over others, and the other that says that security can be achieved through cooperation with each other. And we're very much arguing that the real way to peace, the real way to security for the United States is a way that involves not beating every other country in the world militarily, but working out a common interest with the peoples of the world. And so we're calling for a global Marshall Plan to redistribute the wealth of the world in such a way as to eliminate poverty, homelessness, hunger, to rectify inequalities in education and health care, and to really take seriously the well-being of people on the planet.
That was Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine, which is sponsoring a four-day teach-in in Washington, D.C., June 1st through the 4th. Contact Tikkun at area code 510-644-1200 or visit their website at www.tikkun.org. After Saddam Hussein's 1990 invasion of Kuwait, the United Nations, led by the U.S. and Britain, imposed comprehensive economic sanctions against Iraq, which devastated the nation's economy and infrastructure. 13 years of sanctions, which made it difficult for Baghdad to purchase medicines, fertilizer, and other materials basic for healthcare, agriculture, and sanitation, were, by the U.N.'s own estimates, responsible for the deaths of more than 500,000 Iraqi children. But following the American-led war that overthrew the government of Saddam Hussein, the U.S., now the occupying power in Iraq, prevailed on the U.N. Security Council to end the sanctions on May 22nd. This occurs as the U.S. occupation of Iraq continues to confront lawlessness, slow restoration of basic services, and seething anger over the delay in establishing an interim government. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University and author of Cool War, Economic Sanctions as Weapons of Mass Destruction, a widely circulated article published in Harper's Magazine. She discusses how the U.S. used sanctions to cripple Iraq and the respective roles the U.S. and U.N. will now have in establishing a new government in Baghdad and rebuilding the war-torn nation.
Well, if the sanctions were being lifted and Iraq's sovereignty were reinstated, that would be a very different situation because Iraq would be in a position to pursue its economic development, its exports, its own decisions about humanitarian priorities the way it saw fit. But that's not the case. What's happened instead is that it's a shift from sanctions to occupation by the U.S. and the U.K. And what's also characterized this is a shift from a system that had a high degree of accountability, thoroughness, and transparency to a system that has no oversight, very little accountability at all. So, for example, under the Oil for Food program, what was the case is that Iraq was required to submit a statement of what goods it was going to buy in the next 6 months and show how those corresponded to the humanitarian needs of Iraq. than those agencies within the UN with considerable expertise, UNICEF, World Health Organization, in identifying humanitarian priorities, would participate in identifying what those were and make sure that the goods conform to that. Now that's completely eliminated. All oil sales had to get approved by something called the 661 Committee, a committee of the Security Council. That committee would look at proposed oil sales, determine if the prices were fair, and identify whether or not there might be kickbacks going on. That committee is eliminated under this resolution, as is the Office of the Iraq Program, which is the entity that runs the Oil for Food Program. Instead, the United States is more or less unilaterally in charge of identifying what humanitarian reconstruction will look like. And what we've seen so far is not a willingness to look at what Iraq most badly needs and then meet those needs in an urgent way, but rather what's happened so far is that Iraq's renovation and reconstruction has been approached with an eye toward what the U.S.'s own economic interests are. So let's look at the oil issues. What gets spared in the bombing? The oil ministry, the oil fields. What gets protected against looters? The oil ministry and oil fields. What gets put into operation immediately? The oil fields. What doesn't get spared? Infrastructure, residential areas. What doesn't get put into operation? The water system. And the water system is particularly crucial because that's going to be what causes massive increases in mortality immediately, is what we should expect. Right now, Iraq has virtually no functioning sewage treatment or water purification within the country. So when the U.S. chooses to do nothing to protect water purification installations from being looted, when the U.S. does not put its personnel or Iraqi personnel in a position to put those into operation, it's quite literally condemning Iraqis to deaths based on the epidemics of cholera, typhoid, and child dysentery, which are imminent. And in fact, the U.S. has a track record. If we look at the sanctions regime for the last 13 years, we can see pretty clearly how much the U.S. is or is not interested in making sure that the humanitarian needs of the Iraqi people are met. So over the last 13 years, the U.S. has blocked quite literally billions of dollars of urgent humanitarian goods from entering Iraq. Those have ranged from things like yogurt-making equipment to child vaccines to water tankers during a period of drought to water purification equipment. The U.S. sometimes gives rationales, sometimes gives no rationales. The U.S. has been so aggressive throughout the sanctions regime at blocking humanitarian goods and limiting oil sales that the total goods that were actually delivered in Iraq between 96 and this year under the Oil for Food program came to a total of $180 per person per year. That's one half the per capita income of Haiti, one of the poorest countries in the world.
So what will be the role of the UN now that the Security Council has voted to lift the sanctions?
There's an advisory council that has no binding role in terms of requiring the U.S. to perform certain functions or requiring it to abide by certain standards. The Office of Iraq Program, the agency that made sure that the goods purchased for Iraq conformed with their humanitarian needs, that agency is eliminated. What it is an open-ended authorization of unlimited duration. It will require a new resolution to lift the legitimation of the occupation regime, and obviously the United States could veto any such resolution. So what's happened in effect is that the U.S. occupation of Iraq, following a war which was not authorized under international law or by the Security Council, this occupation is now authorized to continue indefinitely with no end in sight.
That was Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University. Her article, Cool War, Economic Sanctions as Weapons of Mass Destruction, appeared in the November 2002 edition of Harper's Magazine and can be read online at www.harpers.org. Gordon is author of the book, A Peaceful, Silent, Deadly Remedy, The Ethics of Economic Sanctions, forthcoming from Harvard University Press. While President Bush is riding high in U.S. public opinion polls after his invasion of Iraq, the success of his administration's war against terrorism is anything but certain. Recent bombings in Saudi Arabia and Morocco serve as a warning that terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda continue to operate beyond the reach of cruise missiles and laser-guided bombs. And most of the world, overwhelmingly opposed to America's war on Iraq, were not surprised to find that the weapons of mass destruction which the White House used to justify its war on Baghdad cannot be found. Still, many citizens strongly believe that the only effective means to fight the terrorists who viciously attacked America on September 11th and threats from rogue states is through war and violence. But longtime Nation magazine columnist Jonathan Schell, author of the new book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, argues that history has shown us that there are viable alternatives to endless cycles of violence. With so much uncertainty about the terrorist's next target and where the next war may be fought, a discussion of alternatives is welcome and goes beyond a mere academic exercise. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jonathan Schell, who examines the many dangers now facing the world and concludes that war is far from the only answer.
You know, war is always a tragedy, always a horror. As I see it, really, no war is good. Every war starts off wrong, so to speak, because it means the loss of life and injury, and is only tolerable in an extreme case when there's some kind of extraordinary justification. Ernest Hemingway said that every war is a crime, even when it is justified. I guess that expresses my feeling about war.
The Bush administration and a lot of people in this country believe that, you know, with the uncovering of thousands of bodies of people, many innocents who were executed by Saddam Hussein during his long regime, part of which, of course, he was supported by the United States. But nonetheless, people see the solution of war as being justified by Saddam's brutality. And how do you respond to that justification for war? That is often the case throughout history.
The United States went to war because it said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or was on its way to getting them and had to be stopped and disarmed. We went before the United Nations. We argued there for several months about that. So it's really wrong and very damaging to the entire prestige and reputation of the United States to suddenly forget about that and switch the argument. You know, when you go to war, it matters terribly what your justification is. Because war is so terrible, you have to give your reasons to the world and to your own people. So there's something deeply wrong about going to war for one reason, and then once the war has been fought, say, oh, excuse me, we were in there for another reason. Now, it's true that as a sort of secondary matter, very late in the day, the president did mention democratizing Iraq and so forth. But the plain truth of the matter is that that was an afterthought, and it was not the reason the United States went to war. Now, as to the result, you know, however little part of the plan, certainly nobody can fail to be glad that that tyrant is gone, and especially when you see these people searching for their relatives with their own hands in mass graves. So that is something that has turned out well, at least for now. But the for now part of it is also very, very important, because it by no means follows that every liberation is followed by a foundation of freedom. I mean, there are all kinds of revolutions in history of tyrants that have fallen only to leave something just as bad or worse behind. So the jury's kind of out on that at the moment.
Jonathan Schell, after September 11th, those in the peace community were advocating a less or nonviolent means to confront terrorism, the terrorism that brought so much death and destruction here in this country in 2001. How do you respond to the idea that this dramatic strike of terrorism at the World Trade Center in New York and the Pentagon really created a situation that the United States itself had to strike at violently, and that nonviolent means were really not a viable alternative?
Well, you know, if you say nonviolent, it sounds as if some people are going to go and picket the terrorists and hope they'll desist or something like that. And, of course, that would be totally ridiculous. But I actually think that the problem of terrorism illustrates very, very well the virtues of an approach other than war. I mean, it does involve policing, police work. It does involve apprehending the terrorists. But this involves and requires cooperation of other countries, and especially when you are dealing with global terrorism. There's really no hope whatsoever of getting a hold of that unless you have the willing cooperation of allies, and especially in the Middle East. So if you alienate those governments, if you alienate those peoples, you're going to destroy the cooperation on which success depends. And then, of course, as people also point out, you're going to fill up the terrorist ranks with recruits who are going to be very angry. You know, when something like September 11th happens, and I happened to live six blocks from where the World Trade Center was, and so that was a shock to me personally that I will never recover from. And it creates a very natural instinct, which is an ageless instinct, you know, to strike back. But you do have to ask yourself, is that going to actually solve your problem? I mean, the Iraq War is a wonderful example of that. Most Americans thought that we were helping to solve the problem of September 11th by removing the government in Iraq. But in actual fact, there's been no linkage demonstrated between the government there and the terrorism of September 11th. So, you know, if one guy punches you, it's not helpful to punch another guy in response. That doesn't solve your problem. And that's the nature of terrorism. And it needs a response that's other than a strictly military one. If you want to solve it, I mean, maybe you'll gratify certain instincts if you hit back at somebody else who didn't do it, if you just blind yourself to reality. But you actually won't be safer at the end of the day. You'll be more vulnerable.
That was Jonathan Schell, author of The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, published by Metropolitan Books. Read Schell's Nation magazine column online at www.thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.